So, well, I know we have two planet people here, but I don't know about the rest of you, so perhaps you might learn something today. The last time I was here in Santa Barbara was for the Protostars and Planets conference. It's a big wingding every 4 years, although I guess it should be this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's not on No Protostars and Planets. You know how it was every 4 years? It doesn't matter. Anyway, so...
There's been four of them.
I just expected another one. Never mind. And Doug Lynn organised a workshop here at ITP. And today I just want to tell you something about how much we've learnt since then, quite a lot, and especially about the complexities of planets with and without companions that happen to be very close to their host stars. So this is a plot shown by Michel Mayor. Michel Mayor was, and his collaborator were the people who announced the first extrasolar planet around a sun-like star. There were some pulsar planets before that. And that planet was around the famous 51 Pegasus. Now this is a plot he showed at that Protostars and Planets meeting. And he, right from even before these things were discovered, we really wanted to know whether the solar system's unique, whether it's this is how planets form around other stars. And we had it in mind that planets, you'd expect to find planets on pretty circular orbits, and you'd expect to find Jupiters far away from their planets, because if you believe that planets are formed by the accretion of planetesimals, you believe that you need to be far away, or past the snow line, as we call it, to form a Jupiter-like planet. And that the disk would tend to damp out the eccentricity, the disk from which they formed. So this plot was shown, and this was supposed to be evidence for that hypothesis, that planets form on circular-ish orbits, and that things like brown dwarfs and stars formed a different way through fragmentation of cloud or whatever, but different, so that they were left with an eccentricity. So this plot, actually, there's only six extrasolar planets here at the time. That's all they had. It seems like so long ago, but it's not really. And two of them are up here, but they're massive, relatively massive. So these authors argued that they were of this kind of variety, formed in a different way. And they put the solar system planets there, which sort of makes the statistics look better than it really is. And you just ignore those. And what are they? That's probably Pluto and Mercury, so we know how to ignore them anyway. And so that was thought to be all consistent with what we knew. And here are their orbital elements. Well, they're pretty, they realised that these very short period planets are likely to be tidally circularised anyway, so that sort of takes even more out of your statistics. And I think you're left with one planet which happens to be like, with a reasonable period that happens to be like the solar system. So, well, we astronomers are good at doing a lot with very little data, but that's what the state of affairs was then. And here are the two massive guys, and they've got decent eccentricity. Well, it was already known at that time that planets, if they do form out of a disk, can interact with that disk tidally, and perhaps migrate a little bit, in or out, depending on where you are. And in the process, well, some people realised, in particular Pavel Latimowicz, who was here at that last meeting, knew that eccentricity could be excited in that process, or damped, one or the other. So he pointed out to the authors of this paper, he was the referee, that this was also a possibility. So I'd almost forgotten that this was believed in those days, because almost all the extrasolar planets now have eccentricity, except for the very short period planets. So now I'm going to show, with the risk of boring with the list, but there are lots of interesting planets amongst these, and I've colour-coded some of them that have been of interest to me and Doug Lynn, who's my collaborator in Santa Cruz. This one here, the very shortest period planet, less than 3 days, I always wanted to work on, and Doug said, oh, I bet it's not real. And what he was talking about is this has a companion further down on the list that has a period of 29 days. And I said, it's a 10 to 1 resonance, 10 to 1. And he said, ah, the other one will probably go away. And in the meantime, Peter Goldreich and his collaborator did write a paper on this so-called 10 to 1 resonance. And in fact, the other planet has now disappeared from the observer's data. So Doug was right. Doug loves to be right. Anyway, so that's one. Tau Bu was a very early discovery. This is a relatively massive planet, and I'm going to say something about that. This has become interesting because one group claimed to be able to measure its reflected spectrum in the star. And from that, they claim to be able to estimate the size of this planet. And so Peter Bodenheimer and Doug and I wrote a paper on inflation of these extrasolar planets, and we claim that there's no way this could be as big as those guys say. And there's another group that claimed not to ever be able to detect the spectrum at all. So that guy, we're going to mention this one. I have to remember, what's the yellow one? The yellow one. Why am I interested? I knew I'd forget what these things are. This is famous for being the transiting planet. And actually, we discussed this in the same paper. So they can actually, and I'll show the light curve, this beautiful dip in the light curve showing the planet passing in front of the face of this star. Upsilon Andromeda is one that we've spent a lot of time thinking about. It has two companions down here. I'm going to talk about tides and spin and dynamical coupling, and so this has got it all, Upsilon Andromeda, because there are three planets. This group, the light green group, are what Doug and I call the borderline planets. Some of them are eccentric and some of them aren't, so these lot are tidally circularised. These eccentricities are probably, they could be zero. I think, within the errors, probably the errors are as big as the eccentricities that they measure up to there. But here is one that's all of a sudden 0.14, even though it has a very short period, 6 days. And here's another one, same eccentricity, just by chance, but, or maybe not by chance, another short period. And you can see there's a mixture, and there's a few more further on in the list. And what we think is a nice explanation for why there's a mixture there at the borderline. There's a few more of them. This one used to be a planet, but it's not anymore. I don't know what happened to that. This system here is the pair to the 10, that's the 10 to 1, there's the 29 days. So this one should be crossed out too, apparently. I don't know if that's been published, that crossing out result, but anyway. GJ876 is my favourite pair, but Stan Peel here and Manhui Lee have written a beautiful paper on this system. 30 days and 60 days, this system tells us a lot about the formation of planetary systems and how they interact with the disk while they're forming. There's lots of things beautiful about this system, but if you think about it, 2 to 1, two big Jupiter-like planets in a 2 to 1 resonance. These are minimum masses, by the way, because we don't know the inclination to the long line of sight. This is at least two Jupiter masses, and this is at least half a Jupiter mass. So these two guys are managing to be in this 2 to 1 resonance without scattering out. This one has a ridiculously high eccentricity, and we think that system should have a binary companion whose orbit is inclined to the orbit of the planet. And just quickly, another 2 to 1 resonant pair, and there are the other two planets for Upsilon Andromeda. So, first of all, I'll discuss the importance of tides and spin. I'll say a little bit about a code that I've written to integrate the dynamical evolution of these systems. And first of all, well, the various effects, tidal dissipation in the planet. If you have a pair of stars, or a planet and a star, that are close enough to raise tides on each other, and if the orbits, if it's not circular, it'll tend towards circularizing, and the spins will tend to synchronize with the orbital frequency, and the orientations of the spins will tend to align with the orbit normal. So they're the three sort of end points to tidal evolution. So eccentricity, orbital eccentricity, tends to be damped. The dissipation dominates in the planet, and if a planet can't radiate this energy efficiently enough, it will puff up, and so that's relevant to that Tau Bu that I mentioned before, and the transiting planet. I'll say something more about that later. You can also, you raise a tidal bulge on the planet, and this tidal bulge the oscillations try to damp, and the tidal bulge will tend to be misaligned because of that damping with the line of centres. So there'll be a torque, and you transfer angular momentum, and energy in the orbit will tend to circularise. So this energy is derived from the orbit. It's dumped into the atmosphere of the planet, and it has to try and get rid of it. So if it can't get rid of it quickly enough, you're heating it up, it'll puff up. And in some cases, this will be a runaway process, and you actually tidally destroy the star, planet rather. Tidal dissipation also is important in the host star, although people haven't really realised this until now. The star, of course, won't be synchronously rotating with the orbit. Initially, when the star forms, it'll be spinning faster than the orbit, generally. And the planet will try and spin it down through this tidal torque that I mentioned. And, pardon me, that'll tend to push the planet out if the star is spinning faster. If it's spinning more slowly, the planet will try and spin the star up, and at the expense of its orbital angular momentum, so the orbit will shrink. Now, of course, the star, especially these solar mass-ish kind of stars, will suffer magnetic braking in its lifetime. And so it's spinning down in spite of this planet, and this planet's trying to spin it up, and so you can actually have a runaway tidal decay if the planet is close enough. And because of this, we can actually rule out terrestrial structure for these very short period planets, because the damping efficiency of such planets is much, they're more efficient at damping energy. Like the Earth's, we speak of a thing called a Q value, and the Earth is of the order of four orders of magnitude less than a gaseous planet or star. And so these things would have been tidally destroyed. If they were rocky planets, these short period planets, they would have been tidally destroyed a long time ago. That's what I'm trying to say. So some people I've said that to have scoffed at it. Of course they're not rocky, but how do we know they're not?
I'm
not going to say too much more about it. I'm just going to discuss the various systems. So, go ahead.
It was never clear to me how you can actually be certain that for the damping of the eccentricity, that it's not within the star rather than within the planet.
Well, you can just look at the time scales. In fact, I will show something that will give you an indication of how the time. There will be some dissipation in there, but the planet dominates. The rate.
Some presumption of the Q value or something for the planet.
Oh, well, of course you have to assume the Q values for both the planet and the star.
Right.
And I will say something about taking the star into consideration as far as tides goes when I discuss those borderline planets.
Sorry?
You have no limitation made to the orbit of the earth.
No, this is the eccentricity.
I'll show you.
No, but eccentricity can be inside of your band.
Yeah, well, that's true too. If the star is spinning really fast, it can actually excite eccentricity.
Yeah, well, the usual case by selection is that they're slow rotating.
Well, they are, yes, I'll come back to that. Yeah. Now, the other thing of interest especially for these multiple systems, and especially Upsilon Andromeda, is the planet-planet interaction. So I'll say a little bit about the code in a minute. But we put all these things together, all these extra accelerations, in order to integrate itself consistently. Now, what this Upsilon Andromeda, the outermost planet, which is I never remember the numbers for these things. I don't know, 1,500 days or something. That's the eccentricity. That's this one up here. The intermediate planet has a period of, 280 days or so. And the innermost planet's 4.6. Now, if you just treated them as Newtonian point masses and integrated away, taking the observed parameters, it's possible for the inner eccentricity, they all pump it away at each other's eccentricity, but the innermost one can actually increase by an order of magnitude. Now, the thing is, it does this while preserving the semi-major axes. And so it's, in that case, if you preserve the semi-major axis but you increase the eccentricity, the periastron separation shrinks, and you can get the star and the planet even closer, and the tidal interaction is even stronger. And in fact, we've shown for our assumed Q values for these systems that you would get a runaway tidal inflation if you had Newtonian gravity and if you had no other effects. So that's if. If you do put other effects in, including the relativistic potential of the star, as well as the tidal bulge of the planet, and the tidal bulge of the star will be puny, and the spin bulge of the planet and the stars dominate, the eccentricity never gets a chance to grow, and so the planet survives for us to look at it today. So the relativistic potential is actually the dominant effect that saves the planet from tidal destruction. But actually the other effects are reasonably important as well, and I'll say something in a sec.
What do you mean by relativistic potential?
So if we take the post-Newtonian term in the potential of the star, this actually affects the way the periaps affects the rate of tidal advance, and it screws up the sort of perfect symmetries that are in there and doesn't allow the eccentricity to grow. But the tidal bulge of the planet and the spin bulge of the star are also quite important. So the eccentricity is always excited in this system, so there's always dissipation in the planet, but we showed that it's not enough to shrink the orbit on a timescale that's not longer than the age of the star. Planet radius inflates very little. Well, of course, this system's there for us to observe, so these things must be true. Sorry, I missed one there. Now, this is a paper Doug and I've... Well, it'll appear next month, where we describe how we put all this together. So the code can have up to four bodies, and the inner two have structure, so the star and the planet. You specify their radii and the structure constants, orbital motion constants and moments of inertia, and the Q values. And both those bodies can have arbitrary spin orientations and spin frequencies. So we integrate the equation of motion for all the the bodies, and so, for example, the innermost pair, the star and the planet, and you include all these extra accelerations from these various effects. So it's integrated self-consistently. So the other bodies don't see the tidal bulges or anything, the third and the fourth body. And there's a direct code and an average code. The direct code integrates these equations of motion directly and is used for systems where there is resonance, or systems where the semi-major axis will change. And there's an average code which we use for systems like Upsilon Andromeda, where the inner period is much shorter than the other periods. So we orbit average in that case over all these things. Okay, here's the transiting planet, very short period, 3.5 days. This beautiful, beautiful light curve that shows the planet moving across the face of the star. These guys claimed that the precision was high enough to be able to detect a moon around such a planet, at least a moon as big as the Earth. But we showed that a satellite couldn't exist around Jupiter-like planets with periods less than 12 days, because if you move them in close to the planet, they're tidally unstable, and if you move them out, they're dynamically unstable. Does that make sense? This is the planet's period. So if you put a moon around a planet with a period any 12 or less days, it'll be dynamically and tidally unstable. There's nowhere to put it. Does that make sense?
And that would kind of be reflected just because it would add...
You could see a little bump here. They said there's no moon around here, and there certainly shouldn't be any moon around here, but they're saying, you know, another system might have a moon and we'd be able to detect it, and we're telling them that there'd be no such moon there in the first place.
Is that assuming the moon is
missing? No. Oh, well, that's a good point. Yeah, well, it'd have to be, wouldn't it? So you'd expect it to be anyway, because you'd expect it to be in the same plane. Now this is the transiting, the same system where we looked at the tidal inflation of these kind of planets. These authors claim to be able to, using this photometry, claim to be able to measure the radius of this planet. And Peter Bodenheimer mainly did these calculations, and he took a Jupiter-like planet and put a solid core in it, quite a massive one actually, 40 Earth masses, and evolved the thing down onto the planet's main sequence. So he evolved it from a few million years down to up to 4.5 billion years to determine the equilibrium radius, and he found that the equilibrium radius of a planet without a core is about 20% higher than without. So the idea is that, can you use these kind of measurements to determine the origin of these planets, whether they formed via accretion of planetesimals, and so you form a core and then accrete the gas, or whether they formed like Alan Boss would like them to form, by fragmentation or gravitational instability. So, and the other aim of this paper was to examine whether these are realistic measurements. Here are Peter's results for no core and a core, and we can see after 4.5 million years that the one with the core is almost a Jupiter radius, but the one without a core is significantly higher. This, okay, This was for a planet with this mass, which is the minimum mass of this system, and let's see. Well, I've said that.
Can I understand why you say inflate? I mean, my understanding was that it's more that you're halting contraction by having an insulating surface.
Well, you're not halting contraction. Well, okay. That's a good point, because if you assume they reach there very early on while they're still contracting onto the main sequence,
you just
wouldn't have allowed them to ever. Okay.
Well, the question is that they don't have an entropy that's actually it's actually lower still than birth, but it's just not as low as you'd like it given their age.
Something
has slowed down the entropy evolution.
You're right. It's a misnomer. Yeah, well, I have to retract that paper. Published last year. No, retract it. Has anyone ever put in an erratum for a title? That would be new. Yeah. Well, you know, you'd think Peter would have thought of this. Well, he's just used to evolving these things on the main sequence and not putting them around anybody. So you're right. On the halting of the contraction.
What's also strange is there's two other places I know of where you can measure radii.
Mm-hmm.
One is in cataclysmic variables, where you get radius measurements of things that are about 10 Jupiter masses. And there's one neutron star binary where you also have a very low mass. And in every case, you get a number like this, 1.4. There's three different instances I know of. Very different.
1.4 units?
No, I mean, they're always about 30% bigger than what they should be for their mass.
Yeah, okay.
So I always worry whether it's, well, so.
But they are all these are
interpret as either something wrong.
These are eclipses. These are eclipsing photometrically determined systems, are they?
These are both systems that are rotational fillings. They're very tight orbits, so you have the radius because you know its filling is rotational.
Okay.
So there's other contexts where you measure this number as well, and it's also high. And people also talk about things like inflation.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's just a comment about.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Yeah, although small in statistics, yet again, but still, yeah, it is interesting. Well, we conclude that this system must be, well, going back a step, the eccentricity is quite small, and left to its own devices would damp pretty quickly. So we think that this system must have a companion, or we said that it ought to have a companion to be this inflated, this puffed up, this too big. And recently, there is evidence that there is a companion to this system. So the idea is that you need a companion to excite the eccentricity in the orbit of this planet, so that it's continually trying to damp it, and so that energy, tidal energy, tends to swell up the planet. No, keep the planet swelled. Swollen. But maybe there's more to it. Mm. And, well, I commented on this before. If one did discover planets in circular orbits, so with no companions or no nearby companions, with inflated sizes, this would be evidence for the Boss conjecture that planets formed by fragmentation. Okay, Tau Bu is the one I mentioned before that we can supposedly see its reflection spectrum in the star. These guys claim to measure this radius, quite big, whereas these guys claim that there's nothing there, and so the radius must be no more than 1.2. Because I guess that's their detection limit. This system's actually tidally synchronized, the star, at least the outer layer of the star. It's an F-dwarf, so it has quite a shallow convection zone. And the planet is relatively massive, so it's managed to spin up the outer layers of this star. So there's no sort of tidal interaction going on that way. The observed eccentricity is small, and you can see the error is as big as the eccentricity itself. And with a kind of Q value we like to take for these Jupiter-like planets, the circularization time scale is puny. So we really don't think that this Taubeuse should be as big as it is, but maybe there's a secret that we don't know about. So we would tend to agree with these guys, with their null detection, that this Taubeuse is not as big as they say. There are no companions in sight for this. So, Taubeuse. These are Peter's calculations for the he takes a Jupiter-like planet and deposits energy in various ways. Sometimes he put it throughout the envelope or near the core or near the surface, and he claims that it makes no difference to the end result. So he starts with a planet, you know, fully contracted, and then artificially inflates it. And the point of this plot is to show that if you have a massive planet, so this is Taubeuse with its 4.4, it doesn't inflate very much. Even if you put in this much energy, this is in units of the luminosity of the Sun. Upsilon Andromeda is more like one solar mass, a bit less, inflates a bit more, and this other system, 0.8, inflates a lot more, and that's the system, the transiting system. So you would expect to be able to measure its inflated radius if it does have a companion. Okay, the borderline planets, and here they, in particular here, is this mixture of eccentricities, even though their periods are rather short. So one might expect these planets to be circular, but our conjecture is that it's the star's condition in its use that determines the eccentricities that we see today, as well as the structure parameters there. So this is... well, it's slightly different to that older plot I showed before, but this is eccentricity versus period. And the borderline planets have somewhat smaller eccentricity than the rest of them, and some of them are zero. Now, people have always assumed, it gets back to what we were talking about before, that tidal dissipation in the planet is what's important for circularising these things. And so here is the dependence, at least this is for the planet, so this is the time scale for circularisation by damping the planet's tide. So it depends on, well, this is this Q value, or it's a Q prime modified Q value, it takes into account the zonal motion constant as well, or the Love number, so-called. Here's the ratio of the mass of the planet to the star, so you'd be having that inverted. And you have this ratio, and it turns out that if you work out the same thing for the star, that's smaller. So that's why people take the planet to be the main thing. I had these here and I deleted them by mistake, so bad luck. But anyway, so these are time scales. If you take the system now and figure out the time scale for circularization, these is in gigayears, that's their rather long for these guys and shorter for this. But actually the time scale does depend on the star as well, or at least the stars, now it doesn't matter so much because the star is, they're all spinning rather slowly. But in the past, they may have been spinning much faster when they formed. And in fact, if you look at stars in young clusters, like the Pleiades, you'll see a mixture of these G-dwarfs. Some of them have very high velocities. Most of them have lower velocities. And then the slightly higher mass stars, a lot of them have extremely high velocities. So if these planets are coming in and are getting close to these stars while the stars are rapidly rotating, this will affect how we see them today. So the time scale for circularisation isn't just dependent on the planet. It depends on well, here's some boring equations, but it depends on the rate at which the star is spinning at the time. This is assuming the eccentricity is not too big here. And it depends on how the star and the planet compare in mass and radius as well. So in fact, here's this factor beta. If you didn't consider the star, you'd just, well, beta would be 1, but this term can actually make beta negative. In fact, you can even excite eccentricity, as we mentioned before. And so if all this is going on when the planet arrives, as I said, it can leave its mark in the system now. For the two systems that have significant eccentricity, this factor is rather small, which allows the star to be important, whereas for the system, these are the lowest period ones, smallest period ones, for the system that happens to have a zero eccentricity with that short period, this term is not important. Well, and this plot just shows here are the two systems that have significant eccentricity, and it's just looking at that factor that determines whether the star's important or not, plotted against the stellar spin period. So in the star's youth, when the spin was much higher, you could have beta negative corresponds to eccentricity excitation. So it's likely that I should say the planet was bigger in those days too, so the tidal interaction was stronger, and so.
Can I ask, I presume you're using the whole star, or just the convective?
Just the convective envelope.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Good point.
So that mass in there is the mass of the envelope, not the mass of the star?
That should have had a factor. And it does, and our calculations have a factor for the fractional of the mass in there, yeah. Well, just briefly, there's this highly eccentric planet. I mentioned that before, that it's it must have a companion star. There is a star, actually. I haven't looked at this system for a long time, and I didn't publish what I did on this. So I moved on to, there were too many discoveries coming thick and fast from the Lick Observatory. That's the problem working with Doug. He gets his stuff hot off the press, or even before it gets to the press. And so we move on to the next project and before these things are finished. But this system, with this ridiculously high eccentricity, does have a companion star, apparently. And if the orbit of that companion star is highly inclined to the planet's orbit, it will tend to pump up the eccentricity. And the value to which it pumps it depends on that inclination. And in theory, if these things were point masses with Newtonian gravity, if you had the systems, the orbits inclined to 90 degrees, this in principle could go to 1, which is. But in reality, doesn't happen because other effects come in to stop that. This is the longer period. The longer period, 2-to-1 system, we did some work on that. It happens to have an enhanced lithium-6 abundance in the star. Well, some authors say it does and others argue that it doesn't. So we examined the idea of throwing a planet into this star. And actually we're quite restricted doing this because this system's a 2-to-1 system, and if you're going to have a third planet inside the orbit of these two, you don't want to muck up this perfect resonance. So we had to put the planet very close to the star, which is consistent with it tidally degrading and being plunged into this. Well, actually, not plunged. What will happen is this thing will fill its Roche load and push matter through both the L1 and the L2 point and make a disk of material around the star. I said that. GJ876 is my favourite system, but as I said, we have some experts here. I won't say much I won't say anything about how that system came to be, but I will just say briefly about 2-to-1 systems or resonance systems in general, as far as the relativistic potential of the star goes. I mentioned that. I didn't really explain it very well, actually, but There are various effects that various factors of the system that affect the rate at which the periaps of the planets goes around. And one of those things is the relativistic potential. And all these different effects, the spin bulge of the star and the tidal bulge of the planet, compete, you know, have various strengths in this. And so this ratio here, this gamma, is a ratio of the relativistic precession or epsilon advance to that produced by the other planet. And Z's the ratio of the orbital velocity to the speed of light. Let's see, what do I want to say here? My point here is that the relativistic precession will dominate any secular any effects from the other planet in the epsilon advance. For non-resonant systems, so the relativistic precession, the relativistic potential dominates this precession for Upsilon Andromeda, which is not a resonant system. But for this 2-to-1 system, GJ876, or for any other 2-to-1 system, the relativistic potential can never be important. This is something that's probably more of interest to people who think about these 2-to-1 systems, but it's nice to know that relativity is important in some of these systems and not in others. Well, that's something I was going to talk about, but I won't. So, well, I'm finishing a little early, but I'll leave it there. Thank you. Any questions?
I've been pestering Jeff Marcy for 5 years about the bias inherent in their sample and going to taking low rotation rate stars.
Mm-hmm.
Tau Bu is now an example where the rotation rate's been maintained at a high value because of the existence of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, you know, most of their searches are for slow rotators.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask, you know, what's your sense of the number, you know, you've seen and you've looked at a lot of these systems now, I mean, what's your sense of how strong that bias could be in terms of stars they're not even looking at that probably would have a higher incidence of planets? I mean, if I was to design a search today, given everything, I would look for short rotation period, 3 or 4 day stars that otherwise be old. Those are weird.
So the slightly higher mass than these sort of one-tail mass things that they've been looking at. Well, I suppose they had to start somewhere, and I imagine that, well, you say you've been pestering Jeff. I mean, I imagine they're going to start looking elsewhere. For example, that study of these borderline planets, Doug and I, are predicting that if they look at planets around young stars in you know, these young clusters, that they'll find a completely different eccentricity distribution, which is really, I guess, well, related to what you're saying, as young stars, but also slightly more massive stars, which have tended not to spin down, will also have a different kind of setup. It's important. The spin is really important as far as, like, these planets, we're imagining them migrating in, and something stops them from, well, of course, if they go down the plug hole, you're not going to see them anyway. But something, they could be slightly closer and still be there, and they're not, although, you know, the sample's still rather small. Something seems to stop them, and we believe that it's actually the spin of the star that pushes them out. So I guess if you had old stars doing that, you wouldn't find such short-period planets, perhaps. I don't know. And then you've got the evolved stars too, which will be interesting to look at. Yeah.
I think this bias that Jeff uses to get the spin slow rotators, he wants the spectral line size to be as steep as possible.
Oh, I know why.
And if he tries to go to the others, he may not have sensitivity.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's.
You know,
but he didn't need any sensitivity to get this one back. Tau Bu, those are huge.
Actually, yeah, I
We could go do it at, like, ourselves.
These are, well, the radial velocities of these numbers here. And
there's Talbot.
These are very small. A lot of them are very small. It's the reason why it's taken them this long to actually, I guess, design a,
sure,
a spectral a thing set up to be able to measure these. But you're right. Yeah, there's some really high radial velocities in there, and I don't know. I guess that's quite massive.
If you come back in 5 years, will there be hundreds of us?
Yeah, and I'll really bore the sorry, this is being recorded. Bore you there on Dora. Well, I guess so. I mean, it's not my idea of fun to go and look for more and more and more of these and reduce this the data, like, you know, and say, one of the exciting discoveries or potential discoveries, we were talking about this before, this one-to-one thing, they found some system that they can't fit with any kind of Kepler orbit, modified or not. Well, modified, yes. And Greg Laughlin up in Santa Cruz, typically, went away and thought about this. And if anyone knows Greg, you know, he's so full of energy. And he says, yes, one-to-one. So he can fit the radial velocity curve of this weird thing with I think he puts one planet in a circular orbit and the other one on a highly eccentric orbit with the same period and finds a stable setup, and it produces this ridiculous. But anyway, so I mean, this, I suppose there's still amazing things to be found. But I don't know, I'm more interested in things, well, like I call it gravitational chemistry, the way energy and angular momentum move around in small end systems. Planets are special with their very small mass ratios, but I really come from stellar dynamics and I like to think about three and four body systems colliding binaries together and making triples and how and their stability properties and so on and so on. But there are some beautiful things to think about here, and this is definitely the best one, but Stan beat me to that. But I'm sure nature will give us plenty more to think about. I'm sure there'll be plenty more of these resonant systems. And actually, there's supposed to be a 3-to-1 system. Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard about that, no.
See, this is Doug and his secret contacts up there. he won't mind. He knows that if he told me, this is how he gets me to finish some, you know, writing something or whatever, because I have a really heavy teaching load where I come from, down under. And he knows that, but he rings me up and says, Rosemary, there's this really exciting thing I heard today, but I'm not going to tell you until you send me that, you know, the latest draft. And he knows it'll get me, but he wouldn't tell me about a 3-to-1 because he knew I'd drop everything and run off with it. But so it hasn't been announced yet, and whether it's still real depends what day it is, I guess. But yeah, he gets this. Deborah Fisher is his secret contact who tells him about these things.
I thought Deep Throat was going to be identified.
Well, one of his exciting things that he withheld information from me was this: the binary Kuiper Belt object. That's there are several now, I guess. Have people heard about those? Pluto and Charon is a binary Kuiper Belt object, and presumably they found each other in the 3-to-2 resonance and collided and made their own little binary. But these things, these other objects, are very wide, and maybe they were formed by capture, I don't know. But wow, that is so beautiful. That's the kind of thing I really like thinking about. So he let me know that secret just recently. Well, I think it was already in the paper, so I knew about it. But yeah. Anyway.
Will I get you in trouble if I call her and say I heard about it?
I don't remember Doug telling me, don't tell anyone. Oh, but he did say, don't tell Stampeel, so yeah. Yeah.
Well, could you review again the evidence for the canyon, for the transit?
Oh, I can't. That's a Deborah thing.
You had it on your transparency. What was the...
Oh, but there is now evidence for a companion. That's what I said.
What is the evidence?
Oh, well, Deborah telling
radio
Doug.
Velocity.
Oh, radial velocity, yeah. Okay, yeah, so they'll see a trend. I mean, if there is a companion, instead of just seeing this, you'll see it slightly grow, you know, and it'll have its own modulating period.
It doesn't come from the light curve.
No, they're radial velocity curves. Yeah, I guess, you know, it's hard to... The way they detect these things, they look at the spectrum of the star and measure these fine, that's what these velocity things are, these fine, Doppler shifts in some of the spectral lines. And they have some really special way, they use some iodine or something that has this forest of spectral lines, and so they can see them all moving tiny, tiny bit, and that's how they... And so you just get this straight radial velocity curve, and you can figure out the shape of the orbit and so on, and the orientation and all the orbital parameters. But for the multiple systems, they have the primary data for the innermost planet. Well, I mean, it's not... Well, they extract the innermost planet's orbital parameters, and then from the residuals they extract the next one, and then from the residuals they get the third one. So it's a bit scrappy, but yeah. It's not my idea of fun, but of doing that part of it. But anyway, it's been fun thinking about the dynamics and how these other effects, these other accelerations affect things. And the formalism can be applied to not just planetary systems, to multiple systems that happen to have a couple of close bodies. But yeah.
Great. All right, let's thank Rosemary. Thank you.